morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This is a case where the defendant was arrested too early. The police had this container of PCP overnight, and yet they made no attempt to put a tracking device in the package, no attempt to get a what I think is known as an anticipatory search warrant, where if the when the package was taken into an apartment, they could then enter and search the apartment. Instead, all they did was take this package into the lobby of the building, have Mr. Branham sign for the package, and he was then immediately arrested.
I'm interested in the anticipatory search warrant idea. Your view that that's lawful? That what does it say? It says if we find this, if this happens, then there's probable cause and the magistrate rules in advance?
And I believe the Supreme Court has upheld it.
I'm not saying
I know
it's not okay.
A number of courts of appeals have it, and I believe the Supreme Court. And what it says is we have this package that has been examined. It has crack in it, or in this PCP in it. And we put a beeper or transponder, whatever the word is, in it. And then when it's brought into the apartment, if it's brought into the apartment, and only if it's brought into our how, whatever the dwelling may be, then give us the search warrant, authorizes the search. And there's innumerable cases that approve those anticipatory search warrants and show that the police can obviously get them quite easily. That was not done. The only thing Mr. Branham did was sign the receipt that was put in front of him, and then he was immediately arrested. At one point, he had offered to go up. The Officer Green, who was posing as the mailman, said, no, we've got to go up to the apartment to do it. Mr. Branham said, fine, which obviously would have the other people in the apartment, including Ms. Rice, would then have been known to the Officer Green, and he could have seen exactly how the package was handled. But it was so Mr. Branham said, fine, let's go upstairs. And then it was Officer Green who changed that procedure and said, no, we can't go upstairs. We've got to do this in the lobby. Hands him the receipt, he signs the receipt, and he's arrested. That is not enough to show either actual or constructive possession. And the jury was quite troubled. The jury sent out a series of notes about what constructive possession means, about various pieces of evidence they wanted to see, and had various both factual and legal questions for the district court. So this is not a case where the jury just came quickly to a verdict.
What about the fact that he told Ms. Rice that he was expecting a package and asked for her keys?
Well, Ms. Rice's testimony was all over the board.
She did say that in the grand jury, and couldn't the jury have believed her?
She did say that, and the jury could have believed it. It's possible. She said a lot of different things.
The question is only what a reasonable jury could do, as you know. So it may be that a jury could have just thought something else or disagreed, but why couldn't a jury have believed her grand jury testimony?
Even if they did, and as I said, her testimony was all over the board. She said essentially everything she said she asked him to go get the mail. She said he asked her to go get the mail. She said she got packages every 2 or 3 days. People got them for her. She said,
Since we agree that the jury could have believed her testimony that he asked for the keys because he was expecting a package that day.
Still not enough to show he knew what was in the package. There's nothing that shows that he knew what was in that package.
When you say knew what was in, you mean drugs or you mean a specific drug?
Well, I mean PCP because I think the government cites 5 cases in a footnote that say
The statute speaks of controlled substances. Doesn't speak of the drug.
And that may have been true before Apprendi, but after Apprendi, this court has said you can't separate the sentencing part of this court formally said exactly what Your Honor said, that there's a part of controlled substance, and then the other part is
only. The defense counsel has been making this argument, but have we bought into that argument yet?
Let me put it this way. The government cites no case from this circuit. On page 26 of my brief, there's a case from this circuit this year, Douglas, which doesn't address the issue directly but says that the reason the court approved the admission of 404B evidence was approving the admission of the evidence because it made more probable that the defendant knew the nature of the substance, crack cocaine, he was charged with possessing. If that's the reason for admitting 404B evidence, it must be an element of the offense.
Well, but I have some questions about the research in this case on both sides, but I have found 11 circuits that have expressly held after Apprendi, or 10 circuits expressly held after Apprendi. This isn't an element.
Well, there's Jenkins says...
Jenkins does, that's the Sixth Circuit. But there's a Sixth Circuit case that goes the opposite way right before, and another Sixth Circuit case that goes the opposite way right after Jenkins.
Well, let me put it this...
There may be an intra-circuit split.
Let me put it this way. The Sims case, which is one of the cases the government relies upon, says that the person, same thing, that the person knowingly possessed cocaine had to knowingly possess the cocaine.
But in United States versus Shepard, which is an Eighth Circuit case after Sims, they go the other way. So maybe we have a couple of intra-circuit cases, but you do have a statute that says that you have to have knowledge that it's a controlled substance, and you have, that's part A, and you have part B that says the case has to involve certain things, including a certain amount with respect to a mandatory minimum and a specific drug. But the second part of the statute doesn't say anything about knowing that which drug it is. So yes, which drug it is an element, but the knowledge of it is associated in part A only with a controlled substance.
I think that argument had much more force before Apprendi and before this court's decision in Graham and other cases saying that this is not as we formally interpreted it.
What we said in those cases was that it was an element. After, in light of Apprendi, we would interpret the statute as requiring proof of an amount as an element. But we never said that we would require knowledge of proof of an amount as an element.
That's true. This circuit hasn't said one way or the other, I don't think. But there's no reason now that the statute is an integrated statute, not a separate statute, to not import the knowingly element of the statute into all sections of the statute.
The reason is the way the statute is structured. I mean, let me just ask a hypothetical. So imagine that you're a drug dealer and that you have next to you a mule. And you say to the mule, I'm going to put drugs in this box, but I am not going to tell you which kind of drugs are going to be in there, and there's no way you can know. But I want you to know for sure, I'm a drug dealer, and you are my mule. Immune? The mule is immune? Because
well,
you could not possibly know what kind of drugs?
Depends whether the jury believes it or not.
Okay. Let's say that we develop a method better than lie detecting in which we evaluate brain waves. The court accepts it, and there's no question, or let's say 25 bishops watched this event. And they hear exactly. So there is no question about lying.
I think the answer is yes for the enhanced the enhanced penalty parts of the statute.
Yes,
but
immune. Is that that's
not immune, but
can't be convicted.
From the lesser parts of the statute where there's no amounts in all the there's no separation out of amounts. But when you're talking like Mr. Branham was charged with one of these three parts of the statute that the court says is now an integrated statute, as has every court. You got to remember, this court before Apprendi said this statute is knowing possession of controlled substance, and that's just a penalty provision. And of course, that was wrong under Apprendi. And there's no reason to separate out. The knowing is now integrated into the statute. It's one.
I don't remember anybody saying it's an integrated statute. What we said was actually it was a tripartite statute.
Right.
Which is actually the opposite of saying it's an integrated
statute. Well, it's a tripartite statute, but the first part is integrated into the last three parts because they're not separate anymore. So the last three parts, it's now one statute. Tripartite meaning three sections, I think, as opposed to three parts, if that's a distinction. But there's three sections that are not penalty sections. It's a three-section statute that starts with knowing possession and of the substance, and then you have to...
You have to know the amount as well?
Not so clear to me. I don't think that the... Because there's different...
Is there support in the statute for making that sort of type
of decision? Let me put it this way. I think that the statute would support that. The cases I've cited, including the Sims case, which is one of the cases the government relied upon, that say that you have to know the nature of the substance, don't go to, there was no issue about the quantity. I think it would be just as reasonable to say that you should, that someone should know the quantity as well, because that's
part of sentencing. We've been fairly tough on that.
Pardon me?
We've been fairly tough on the government in terms of demanding evidence that the defendant was on notice of quantity.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me there's all kinds of Sixth Amendment problems if you say that there's no knowledge, the fact of the enhanced penalty. So the Sixth Amendment, I think, is tied into the recent Supreme Court cases on the requirements for proof of every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury.
Sixth Amendment cases only apply if it's an element. This is sort of a big circle we're drawing here.
True enough.
If we decide it's an element, then there's a Sixth Amendment problem. If we decide there's not an element, then it's not a Sixth Amendment.
Yes, I agree with that. There are, let me put it this way, at least the Seventh Circuit case I cite, this court's decision in Douglas, which said the 404B is admissible because it shows the person knew the nature, there would be no reason to say that unless that was an element of the crime, of the substance that it was crack. The Sims case, the Jackson case, in my mind, they're more consistent with Apprendi than are the cases that go the other way and say it's not an element of the case. I mean, the Supreme Court has been quite a stickler about saying that every element of the case has to be proven and reading statutes in the manner that everything in the statute is an element of the offense. So I think it's far more consistent with the Apprendi line of cases and its progeny than it is to say that it's not an element anymore, which is more consistent with all the circuit's prior readings of the statute, which said it was a separate.
Can I just ask you why you resist the government's proposal of a Cole remand? And I'm not talking about your arguments. I'm talking about your strategy. It seems to me that with a standard remand for resentencing, the defendant's at the risk of getting a higher sentence, which is not a risk in a Cole remand. It's hard for me to see what benefit there can be.
Because I think that there's more issues that can be raised on a full resentencing than there are in a Coles remand situation. You can raise other issues. A Coles remand situation seems to me limited to would the judge who knows.
I don't know about that. I mean, the rules set up a structure for what the defendant must assert with respect to sentencing and when he must assert it, and if those assertions aren't made, I think they're lost, unless there's some explanation as to why there was no need to make them.
Well, and of course, this was done when there was a mandatory guidelines regime and many of the factors were forbidden from being considered by the district judge or not relevant. So it was a whole different sentencing structure of issues that could not or would not be raised under the old system. There must be a reason why I'm asking for it in the government isn't. Let me put it that way. They obviously feel the same
or
way.
They obviously
feel this. I think that more issues are open to the district court on a full Booker resentencing than they are on a limited Coles remand, which, as I've said, is impossible in this case in any event.
Do you think
impossible.
There could be a higher sentence on remand? We've indicated that it would violate the ex post facto law, the ex post facto clause, if a version of the guidelines which was not in effect at the time of the crime, raised a higher sentence. Here the Supreme Court has totally and completely changed the sentencing law by their own admission. It's not as if they're reinterpreting what the law had always been. They've declared part of it unconstitutional and established a new regime. Would it be possible to sentence somebody under a new regime higher than the sentence that would have been appropriate?
Not in a case like this, I don't think, because there's no changed circumstances and the district court treated them, gave us, if the district court had given a large downward departure, that might be a different situation, but this was within the mandatory guidelines and there's the whole vindictive sentencing issue that plays into it.
Vindictiveness.
Pardon me?
Absent vindictiveness. It would seem to me that, yes, there are two different regimes. It's very hard for me to see that the post-Booker regime is systemically more severe than the pre-Booker regime. And it would seem to me that it's that sort of change in regime that is involved in these cases limiting what can happen on resentencing.
Let me put it this way. My experience is that cases that have gone back on full Booker resentencing, there's never been a higher sentence in this district than what was imposed.
That may be the case. That may be the case. I'm just saying there's not, I don't see any legal protection against that.
It's, well, let me put it, I don't want to give into that because it's not argued in the briefs and it was, the government didn't argue that and so I didn't have a chance to respond to it in the briefs. I think there would be serious impediments to a higher sentence on for a number of reasons. Both the fact-finding by the initial district judge as well as the whole vindictive framework that applies to when there's a victory on appeal or sentence is reversed on appeal.
You're just arguing that under the resentencing, because of the change post-Booker, you'd be able to get in a lot of new stuff.
Right.
Maybe so. Maybe the government can, too. Why not?
Could be.
Right?
Could be.
About factors that were excluded before or considered satisfactory, completely covered in the guidelines,
right,
would now be open.
Yes, I think that's right. The government is equally unfettered, so to speak, by...
I would think so.
...by what they said previously, if they think that there's additional factors that either could not have been raised or would not have been raised. I do want to just emphasize that regardless of which way the court holds on whether Mr. Branham had to know it was PCP, the evidence is totally lacking that he knew it was any type of controlled substance in the package. So I think that's not crucial to my argument. It's part of my argument, but not at all crucial. There's no evidence that he had any idea what was in the package.
Get back on the Coles remand just for one second. The difference between the Coles and vacating and starting over again is being able to put in evidence, let's see, is the only difference, one, the presence of the defendant, and two, being able to put in evidence of events that have occurred since the time of the sentencing? Because in the Coles remand, you can put in all the factors that were not relevant at the original time.
Right. So I think there's those three things. All the factors that would, yeah, the only difference between Coles, yes. I'm sorry.
The only difference, so right. In a Coles, you don't get the defendant present, although apparently in the Second Circuit's compromised view of the Coles, Crosby, you do. But
right.
Leave that aside for the moment. In a Coles remand, the defendant doesn't appear. You can't put in evidence as to what's happened since the sentencing, that is, a rehabilitation or something.
I think...
Maybe that's undecided.
I think that's undecided.
Okay. Well, if it's undecided, what do you see as the difference between...
Well, I think the government would clearly argue at a Coles remand that everything is limited to what... up to the time of the original sentencing, and you can't bring that in, so it makes
it... Is that the only difference? I mean, what more would you get in a... except, of course, all the judge says is, would it be materially different? But in terms of what you get to put on, what's the difference?
I think the main difference is the fact that between a Coles remand, I think there's some import to the presence of the defendant as well, a judge,
right,
especially in this case where the judge who's going to be doing the resentencing never saw the defendant.
I understand that. Maybe I misread or maybe I've assumed. I thought the government agreed that you could have a defendant.
Well, they said that at one point, and then they said there's no need to vary from Coles at another point in their argument.
Right.
So,
other than the presence of the defendant, what else?
The factors that you can argue at the resentencing after the time of the original sentencing. There's also that. And Mr. Branham has participated in a number of programs in prison that I think would be relevant to the resentencing. But again, let me emphasize that I think we should never get to that point because the evidence was woefully insufficient to, regardless of whether he clearly, even under the circuits that say you don't need to know that it's PCP, you clearly have to know it's a controlled substance. And there's absolutely no evidence of that. He signs the slip and they arrest him, and that's it. So
thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Mary Christobi on behalf of the United States. It was entirely reasonable for the jury to conclude that Mr. Branham knew what was inside this package, especially when all of the evidence is viewed cumulatively and in the light most favorable to the government. As Judge Garland pointed out, Ms. Rice testified before the grand jury, which testimony was introduced as substantive evidence at the trial.
What about his knowledge of the PCP? Do we need to reach that?
Your Honor, the government's position is that he did not need to, the government doesn't need to show that he knew it was PCP. They only need to show that he knew it was a controlled substance. To the extent that that issue was raised as an Apprendi issue in the reply brief, the government's position is that at least several circuits have held to the contrary. The Seventh Circuit has explicitly rejected that position, and our position is that the government need only show that it was a control, that he knew that it was a controlled substance.
Was there sufficient evidence even to conclude that it was, that a reasonable jury could have concluded it was the drug that actually ended up in the box? So if the jury concludes that this guy is a drug dealer, he's waiting for the box since drug dealers don't generally offer a complete across-the-board array of kinds of pharmaceuticals, would it not be reasonable to, particularly with respect to PCP, would it not be reasonable to expect that he would know, particularly since in the refrigerator were two vials of PCP?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I mean, so maybe we don't need to reach this question.
That is correct also, Your Honor. There, the reasonable inference was that he was distributing PCP out of that apartment and that they only had two vials left in the freezer. As Your Honor notes, there was significant amounts of evidence tying the defendant to apartment 5112, where there was both the PCP, the bags for distribution, and also the marijuana outside the bathroom window. And in addition, one of his friends, who he had spent hours in the apartment with, was arrested with $2,000 in cash on his person. The defendant went down and asked the postman what he was doing at the building, and asked the postman if the package was for Barbara Rice. Ms. Rice testified on her direct that she was not expecting a package that day. So the jury was entitled to conclude that the package was intended for Mr. Branham and not for Mrs. Rice.
What was the testimony about the bags for distribution? Was that for marijuana or was that for PCP?
The bags were for marijuana. That was the testimony from the expert that the government called at trial.
And there was testimony that marijuana and PCP were often distributed together?
That is correct, Your Honor. So the government's position is that there was sufficient evidence.
Can you say something about the Coles remand? First, do you or don't you agree that the defendant can be present, even under your theory, on the remand?
We agree that the defendant can be present.
Right.
Can in the sense of has a right to?
Can
or
in the sense.
The judge can order him in.
Can in the sense that the better view under the Second Circuit's reading is that for the judge to become fully familiar with the prior proceedings, and then also for the public's perception and the party's perception of fairness, to go ahead and have the defendant be present for the Coles remand.
So what do you see as the difference then?
The government has 2 to 3 different differences. And the primary one that was not mentioned during the initial colloquy was the consideration to be given to Judge Jackson's views on what the defendant should be sentenced to. The Second Circuit mentions that, at least to the extent that, although the resentencing judge, the new sentencing judge, will formulate his or her own opinion.
How is it possible to figure out which Judge Jackson? I actually don't understand your theory of collective scienter with respect to the entire district court, as if they're the Borg from Star Wars, from Star Trek. But getting past that, how could they possibly know what Judge Jackson thought, other than that this was within the guidelines and he was sentencing within the guidelines?
Well, to the extent that he offered an opinion as to what the sentence should be, 132 months, I think, in this case.
Right, but if we thought from reading that transcript that we knew that he was sentencing that way because of the guidelines, we would vacate. And if we thought that he was doing that because he thought that was the right thing, then we would go the other way and we would affirm. And we're in neither of those positions. At least your brief isn't arguing for either of those positions. Your brief is arguing we're in the middle, right? We're in the usual Cole situation where we haven't the foggiest idea.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but at least in the Garcia case, there was indications about whether or not the old sentencing judge, the one who had retired, had views about the domestic situation of the defendant and how that came into play, at least in his sentence.
I understand that in general, but are there any such views here?
Well, to the extent that he selected a sentence at the lower to middle end of the guideline range.
We rejected that as being relevant before, okay. Right? Isn't that right? We have rejected that.
There was no other indication on the record from Judge Jackson in this particular.
Looking into Judge Jackson's mind. What's the second thing?
The second argument would be the one that was mentioned on direct, and that is on the initial discussion, which was that there would be a difference in the types of evidence and arguments that could be made.
And the difference being events and arguments occurring after the date of the original sentence.
Yes.
Now, is there anything else?
Well, to the extent that the arguments would be directed at whether or not the sentencing court would have imposed a different sentence materially more favorable to the defendant had it been fully aware of the post-Booker regime versus calculating a guideline sentence out of thin air, which appears to be a different sort
you
of.
You mean an advisory guideline sentence?
An advisory guideline range, at least for purposes of.
But that just changes it from a one step to a two step, right? If the judge says, I would have, or if, on your theory, that he, and the judge says the other judge would have made a material difference, then we would vacate the sentence under those circumstances and we'd start all over again, right?
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but this court established the Coles remand procedure as the most efficient way for answering that question, and to scrap it simply because the district court judge is retired, the government doesn't think that's warranted.
But simply because is, of course, the issue here. We said in Coles this was a subjective matter. That is the mind of the district judge, and the way we could find out was by asking, but we don't have that available here.
Well, the second...
I'm just reading from Coles. The return to the district judge is for it, district court, is for it to decide whether it would have imposed a different sentence, materially more favorable to the defendant, had it been fully aware of the post-Booker sentencing regime. It seems to me that's, in other words, the subjective element there, I think, is in the application of the post-Booker sentencing regime to the circumstances, right? In other words, what historically happened is a benchmark, and the judge on the Coles remand determines whether he or she would have imposed a materially more favorable sentence than that. I'm just not sure that the mental state of the initial sentencing judge is relevant.
Well, the Second Circuit's decision discusses that to some extent, at least to the extent that the district courts, as a general proposition, have extensive sentencing experience and also experience in developing records. So another district court judge, although it may be it may require a little adjustment in the Coles remand procedure, at least having the defendant present, but another district court judge with similar types of sentencing experience and experience in developing records could at least respond to this court's inquiry about the prejudice prong of Booker and the Sixth Amendment.
I guess my question doesn't presuppose sort of a homogeneity in the district court. It's just that the question under Coles seems to me to take one thing as given, which is given, and then the question is what a district judge, this particular one it ends up before, whether he or she would impose a materially more favorable sentence now that he or she knows of the post-Booker flexibility.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is the normal course under the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure for another district court judge to step in when one is unavailable.
Yeah.
And we would submit that that is the course that should be taken in this case, and that simply because Judge Jackson has retired, the Coles remand procedure should proceed, and with the adjustment of having the defendant present.
Sentencing in this case took place in June of 2004. Why are we only getting this case now? And I don't ask that because I'm upset about this, but I'm asking that on the question of how many more of these are there likely to be anyway?
Well, and there has subsequently been the Judge Penn. There are a number of circumstances.
But it has to be, a pre-Booker sentencing,
exactly,
as well.
Because Booker's not retroactive, so it seems like much ado about very little. Maybe in another circuit in which, you know, there's a lot of issues about the court's time and the judge's time, but how many cases are there?
Well, it's a very narrow range of cases. The government, I mean...
Anyway, it is a very narrow range of cases, right?
Right.
Okay. But do you know why is it that we're only seeing this one now?
Oh, I think part of the problem was that there were 900 pages of transcripts, as my colleague mentioned. So I think there was at least initially a lot of difficulty in obtaining. And then the review of them was quite extensive. If there are no further questions... the government asks that the judgment of conviction be affirmed and requests a limited remand under Coles with the presence of the defendant.
Mr. Kramer?
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to point out that the government's expert that was called Detective Brennan said that it used to be that PCP was shaken on marijuana, parsley, and smoked. But he says that disappeared 7 or 8 years ago. This is on the March 11th transcript at page 113 and 14. He said now that it's come back, it's sold in clear glass bottles with a little top, and it's called a dipper.
Let's suppose the defendant is a full-line drug peddler. no specialization at all. In order to uphold the conviction at all, we have essentially to find prearrangement, right, to have the package sent to him.
Right.
Even if he's a knowing anticipation of this very package, even if he's a full-line drug peddler, it seems to me it's virtually inevitable to infer that he knows, or at least has every reason to think, what will be in the package.
Not like some surprise package you get.
The problem
Halloween is approaching.
You don't know what's in the box.
Well, the problem, of course, is who sent him down to get the package, whether Ms. Rice sent him down or he went down on his own. But bigger than that, there's nothing to connect him with drug dealing. There was marijuana outside the bathroom window where Mr. Stewart had just come from the bathroom when the police
came. Yeah, that's going to the broader.
There was some. There was
whether there's enough evidence at all, putting aside the
Sorry. There was a tin with little clear plastic bags, empty, covered tin. And there were two bottles of PCP in the freezer where Ms. Rice testified only Mr. Stewart had been. There was nothing to connect Mr. Branham with any drugs found in the apartment. There was nothing to connect Mr. Branham with any drug dealing. There was no evidence presented that he had any drug dealing, had been involved in any drug dealing. This is a person who came down the stairs, asked for a package, signs the slip, and is arrested. There was nothing. There was even Mr. Stewart had some cash on him. Yes, Mr. Branham didn't have cash on him. The officer testified usually there's a gun. Mr. Branham didn't have a gun. Officer Green said there's a danger when the person comes down to get the package. He has a gun. He didn't have a gun. There's just nothing to connect Mr. Branham with drug dealing. It's all just these amorphous inferences, not from any evidence. It's just there were drugs in that apartment where he did not live. Mr. Stewart lived in the apartment 3 or 4 days a week. Mr. Branham did not stay overnight, evidently. Mr. Branham did a lot of errands for Ms. Rice and got packages for her on numerous occasions. So this notion that he's some kind of, and all that there was in the apartment, there was 1.5 grams of marijuana outside the window. That's 1/14th of an ounce. And there was these two little bottles of PCP in the freezer, and I don't think we know the amount of them. So this notion that this is a full-service drug dealer, or that Mr. Branham,
I was introducing that in your favor on the PCP issue.
Well, I mean, there's just nothing to show that Mr. I misunderstood, for which I apologize. Had I known, I would have not argued at all.
Maybe you want to sit down while you're at it.
Snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, although in any event, there just was no evidence that Mr. Branham was involved in any drug dealing in this case. All he did was sign the sheet. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case. Thank you to counsel on both sides.